The Disability Issues Minister's been forced to clarify changes to funding rules that were introduced without notice on Monday and have caused widespread concern within the sector. Whaikaha, the Ministry of Disabled People, revealed changes to purchasing rules for equipment, modification supports and other service supports on Monday. So far, 10,000 people have signed a petition against the changes, which disability and carer groups say will make it difficult for them to access electronic goods like iPads and travel outside of their community. Here's some of the feedback that families of disabled people have been sharing. These comments have been voiced by us.
This is very distressing news for our families. The changes mean much needed sensory and communication equipment for our blind and low vision children is no longer a priority and may not be funded. It also leaves our parents vulnerable and without much needed supports. We are highly concerned about the implications of this.
We're on individualised funding after my husband had a stroke. The changes will completely change our lives. I don't know how I will ever get a break. He has severe aphasia, making communication with a constantly changing carer workforce impossible. That's if we can even get a carer from the agency. We're using the funding for community garden activities, weekends for him with family out of town, and gym memberships. After talking with our host, it doesn't appear we'll be able to do any of this. We're on benefits, we can barely afford food, rent and power. There's no way our limited budget can find respite activities. He's been crying, I'm feeling distraught, and I doubt we'll ever have our full funding allocation. I assume this is the intention. He gets severe anxiety and won't go to a facility. What am I supposed to do for respite? Wander the streets? I don't know what will happen to us. The stroke has already negatively affected both our mental health.
This will be hugely detrimental to my son and family. We have next to no family support and receive no respite in terms of caring for my son, which is damaging to myself and my partner, and especially my son, as well as at times we cannot be our utmost best to him. Limiting the respite we can receive in the ways we deem fit and that work for our family will have a massive negative effect. We are so angry. This is a massive setback. We receive this funding and we should be able to dictate what works for us, as each family and disabled person is different. No public consultation, no nothing. It's a mockery of the work we do day in, day out.
In a small town where there are no carers available to provide respite, this will mean I will struggle as a single mum. No more respite purchases, which saved us big time. This is so unfair.
Those have been voiced, but they are the words of families of disabled people who've given feedback since the announcement of these changes. As we said, it was barely an announcement. It was found out by Facebook and other means on Monday. Well, the Minister for Disability Issues, Penny Simmons, told Morning Report a short time ago that funding cuts aren't being made for travel in the community. This won't stop mileage pay. And she also said that vital equipment like iPads, for example, or noise-cancelling headphones for people with sensitivities, say people on the autism spectrum, that it should not affect availability of that as well. The question is, what does it affect and what doesn't it? That's the question so many people have this morning. She says the fund is as much as $65 million in the red, and now is the time to introduce, quote, some conditions and some rules, unquote. The Ministry of Disabled People has apologised for the way it's communicated the changes, and its Chief Executive, Paula Tesorero, will be with us shortly. But first, Prudence Walker is Kaihotu Tika Hoatanga Disability Rights Commissioner. Kia ora and welcome for your time. Thanks for your time, Prudence.
Kia ora, Catherine. Thank you for having me.
Were you given any advance warning about these changes?
No.
So this has come as a complete surprise to you as much as everybody else.
That's right, yep.
What is your understanding of the new rules?
So I'm seeking to understand the detail and impact of these decisions, and we'll follow those up with Whaikaha and with the Minister. But community response has been huge, and I'm concerned not only about the details of the announcement, but about the impact on disabled people's trust of the system. So I know that there's been lots of stories with lots of examples, but just picking up on the travel, for example, there are disabled people who need support to be able to travel, and that travel might be for their job. But it's personal care that they might require, for example, in that. And so, as we've heard, it's already hard enough to get the right support that people need and to get people to support that. And now, many of the comments we've seen, people are concerned that they won't be able to carry out their jobs because they can't have, for example, a support worker travelling with them, or that won't be funded.
And that's for domestic travel beyond local travel, going to get groceries or, beyond community level travel. That's for domestic travel and potentially international travel.
Correct. That's the concerns that we're hearing from people.
The self-care services, and the document references things like massages, pedicures, and other appearance or therapeutic care that are not for the direct benefit of the disabled person. What would be the circumstances in which that is happening? Prudence.
So I'm not really aware of too many specific circumstances around that. And I understand that that sort of clarification is in there to make sure that any of those things that are being funded are of benefit to the disabled person. I guess where the questions from community come from are around, well, if a carer, the example of a bad back and a massage helping that, is that seen as direct benefit to the disabled person? So, yeah, there's further clarification. I think people have a lot of questions around things.
So that might be a family carer, for example, who's working 24/7 essentially, or is available 24/7 to the client, to their family member, and it may be a massage for them. Is that what we're talking about?
That's so far as it reads here. But also, it's a case by case basis. People's needs are different. Disabled people's needs are all different. So for some disabled people, something like a massage may be a cost that they specifically incur because of their impairment or disability. So it's not, it's different in each
Yeah,
situation
this
for
is under the
individual.
carer support column of the document that we have. I'm going to try and get more clarification, Prudence. I'd love you to stay with us while we do that in a moment with the Chief Executive. But respite activities. Now, we heard in some of the feedback there someone caring for a severely affected stroke victim, and those respite activities included community garden, weekends with family or away with family, gym memberships. Can you speak to examples like that? And the case for them, because clearly there's now a case being made that this is not going to be appropriate spending.
Well, look, as I've said, on a case by case basis, people's needs are different, and it takes different efforts to ensure the upholding of the rights of the disabled person. So, on the face of it, the process for making and announcing these decisions seems to be inconsistent with the right for disabled people to be involved in decisions that affect us, and also not in line with the principles of EGL and Whaikaha's commitment to working in partnership with tangata whakaha Māori, disabled people and whānau. So I think, that's really where things come from. While people do have individual concerns about will I be able to fund this or will I be able to fund that, I think it's pretty clear from the response and from what's being communicated from Whaikaha that disabled people haven't been involved in these decisions to date.
The EGL that you referred to is Enabling Good Lives, and this has been a
Yes.
long-standing move to give more autonomy to individuals over how their funding is used and over what they need to live good lives, right?
Correct.
And is there a situation here where those principles have been have been failed here, or is there still room to talk about boundaries and limits, as the minister was talking about, but to do those with the people who are being affected?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I understand, of course, that, you know, the ministry has a operational budget to meet, and that is not endless. I guess in principle, you know, with the introduction of the new ministry, there was an indication made about the commitment to enabling good lives, and we thought that that was a commitment also to upholding the rights of disabled people. So those conversations do need to happen with us about, you know, how that's managed. And I'd just like to add some context that, you know, when we're talking about people who receive these formal supports, that's actually a really small proportion of people who identify as disabled people. And so it is people who already meet that criteria getting it, but there are so many barriers for disabled people in general, the population of disabled people. There's so much more expense that we incur because of our impairments and disabilities. And so I think that just adds some context to this. It's a small proportion of people we're talking about, and everybody in that population is already facing so many barriers. And of course, a lot of disabled people are on low fixed incomes, and really just, yeah, face so many barriers to living a good life.
Prudence, one more piece of context before we bring in Paula. And emailers are saying this, individualised funding, and this person says, I'm a user of individualised funding. Individualised funding rules were relaxed in 2020. When COVID hit, many disabled people struggled to get carers into their homes. The rules were relaxed somewhat. However, the agency I use has strict criteria around spending, so it surprises me to hear what some others might be spending on, if it's manicures and the like. So is there a context where the rules were liberalised, if you like, in the context of COVID, where it was so hard, as this person says, for people to get care in their homes? And is there a case to look closely at what those criteria are? But to do it better than this, Prudence?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I just reiterate the involvement of disabled people in those conversations. I think that while COVID did open things up a bit and push that along, I think a lot of this work, we'd already been looking at flexible systems and how the system can be more responsive to the actual support needs of disabled people, rather than just saying, well, here's a bucket of money, but these are the only things that you can use it for. So, you know, disabled people and their whānau for tangata whaikaha Māori for generations have been trying to move towards a system that better meets their needs.
Yeah, Miki Nui, stay with us, please. Prudence Walker, Disability Rights Commissioner. The Chief Executive of the Ministry of Disabled People is Paula Tesariro. Tēnā koe, welcome. Thanks for your time, Paula.
Tēnā koe, Catherine.
Can you explain what has happened here that has caused such upset, please?
Yeah, this is a really challenging time for our community. And what I want to emphasise is a number of things. So firstly, we'll be putting out some information this week just to clarify some situations, because some of the examples and things that have been used over the last 24 hours are not quite right. So it's incumbent on us to make sure that we're really clear in that messaging. I want to make sure and reassure people that disabled people still have the flexibility that existed pre-COVID, and it is the changes since COVID that we have put a pause on. And I really want to emphasise, Catherine, for our community, that this is a pause, and it was a pause that we had to take in some quite urgent circumstances where the budget was no longer able to provide for some of the core essential things. And so what we've had to do is ensure that disabled people receive the support they need. And we've had to prioritise that spending to things like ensuring that people can have access to wheelchairs and, you know, core essentials. This is a really challenging time. I also want to really reassure people that we value the role of carers, that carers can still get respite and there's some flexibility there, that disabled people and carers are still able to rely on friends and family and choose who their carer is, still able to go out in the community, participate in community activities with their support worker that's funded. So just really want to reassure people of that.
Okay.
And clear messaging out.
Can we work through some of this? And the problem is the clarity wasn't there, was it, in what appeared on Facebook and elsewhere on Monday. But let's just try and get this clarity. For example, the travel. Community-based travel will still be funded, right? But what we're hearing is that domestic, so out of town, and international travel won't be. So here's one emailer saying, will my disabled freelance daughter be able to accept invitations to speak in other cities if domestic travel is banned? Can she continue to do her work? Are holidays now banned for disabled people? Airlines expect many disabled people to travel with carers. Can you answer?
So this is a pause while we are laser focused on getting the settings right. So what we're dealing with in this situation, Catherine, is, you know, what works for one family does not work for another family or individual. We know that, and we know how important flexibility is for disabled people and their families. The challenge that we've got here is a fixed budget with flexible settings. And because of that, and because of half of the $2.3 billion that we spend is spent on residential settings, we are in a situation where the flexibility post-COVID has increased the budget from $220 million to $550 million. So in 2 years, it's actually doubled. And so when we're trying to provide for flexibility within a fixed budget, what we now need to do is get the settings right for the longer term, and that's what we're laser focused on working with our community to do.
Could you explain what is $50 to $65 million in the red? Is that an entire budget, or is it this particular fund?
It's the entire budget. So the way that the Disability Support Services budget works is there's about $2.3 billion. Half of that money is spent on residential facilities, and the other $1 billion is spent on community based supports. And so that's things like child development services, it's equipment and modification services, so things that people rely on, you know, in a day-to-day basis, things as you know, really stark as cochlear implants and wheelchairs and, you know, the difference between remaining in hospital or being able to leave hospital with equipment. And these are the really difficult choices that we've had to make. And so what we've done is we have reduced the flexibility that was put in place post-COVID. So pre-COVID, travel wasn't funded, equipment wasn't funded, and we know how important that is to people, and we really want to get that right within the fixed budget that we've got. And so what we're going to be doing in the coming months is working really closely with our community, because that's where we want to put the energy, is not on a pause situation, but really working with our community to get the settings right for the future.
If that budget has more than doubled, what has driven that? What is the nature of spending that has driven that doubling?
So it's a number of things. So one, we get about 3,000 new people who join our system every year, and there's no automatic budget adjustment for that. So that's about 3,000 people. We get about 5,000 who join and about 2,000 who leave, so the net being 3,000 people. Also, as you know, the general cost of living and cost of things has increased, that's also had a really significant impact on our providers. So those residential services and supports that I talked about, and things like equipment. And so those are the two major costs. And then more and more people are choosing, understandably, because it works, people are choosing flexible ways of funding. And what is not right in the system is the settings to enable that flexibility within a fixed budget, and that's what we need to work on.
So it's impossible, frankly, to accept that this is not about saving money, because if the budget's not adjusted for that population growth, 3,000 new people each year, each and every year, and if it's not unjust, inflation adjusted for the cost of increased cost of equipment and other provisions and accommodation provisions, then this is about saving money, isn't it?
So I have, our Waikaha has, no legal authority to spend money that we don't have. And so we have to manage within the appropriation that Parliament sets. So within the budget that we're given, there is no authority to spend outside of that. And so that's the challenge that we've got. How do we ensure that people who access residential supports can continue to access that, who access child development services, who get equipment and modification services, which is about 100,000 people a year? You know, this is really, really challenging. And so
I appreciate you can't say it, but what I'm going to say is that claims that this is not about saving money cannot be stood up in the face that the fixed costs have increased and the funding of those fixed costs have not.
So that's right in a budgetary sense. And so what we're doing now is two things: working really closely with our minister around the budget process for next year, and secondly, working with our community to really try and get the settings around that flexible funding right, because we know how much that matters to people.
Can you explain within the budget, so you've explained half of the $2.3 billion budget goes on residential settings, which leaves us about a bit over 1.1 for the funding for people being living in their own homes, right? Now, what proportion of that budget is now called flexible, pertains to this fund?
So it's of the total budget, it's about 34-35%.
Of the total $2.3 billion.
Of the total.
So that makes it about half of the budget that is not pertaining to residential care. And is this known as, just help me and forgive my ignorance, is this known as individualised funding? This is what we're talking about, the same thing?
So setting aside the residential funding, and also just to, I'll also set aside the additional money that's spent on equipment and modification services, so that's about 10% of the budget. 34% is on what you're talking about, which is sort of community-based supports, and that includes individualised funding. It also includes personal budgets. So that's where the flexibility around, there's a range of flexible funding arrangements.
Help me again, when we are talking about the funding of employed carers, is that part of the flexible funding?
Yes, but people can still pay for their carers. That's absolutely not changing.
I understand that, and that's why I'm asking it, because the employed carers does not seem to be relevant to any of the changes that we're making here. This seems to be more to do with respite activities or services where there's going to be this debate about whether it directly benefits the client or not, and yes, they're going to have a view on that.
Yes.
And then support that can be given perhaps for carers, as we said, who might be available 24/7, and whether the client has the right to decide they're going to give that person a gift or not and claim it as an expense,
yes,
or whether or not that person can travel with them and claim it as an expense.
Yes, so it's largely equipment and travel with the post-COVID settings. And I really want to emphasise, Catherine, that this is a pause. This and why it's a pause is to ensure we can stay within the budget this year and prioritise our spending to make sure that we're not reducing spending.
Why did it get to this? We are nearing the end of March and the budget is in 2 months' time. And why did we get that close to the budget and have to suddenly do this pause? What's the backstory?
So the story is that it became clear to us pre-Christmas, and that's when we started talking actually to members of our community about the really challenging fiscal situation that we were experiencing. And then after Christmas, we started to talk to our sector about the challenges. We thought that December might have seen a really sharp increase, which it did, because that's often a time when families, you know, need particular support around Christmas and holiday periods. And we wanted to see whether that was just a bit of a blip in December or whether it continued. In fact, the situation started to get worse, and worse in terms of from a budgetary perspective. And what happened post-Christmas is the money that was allocated to equipment and modification services was almost entirely used up, and that was notwithstanding a 10% increase on that budget this year. And so we are forced with this, you know, this really difficult set of circumstances about, do we put a pause on the flexibility so that we can pay for equipment and modification services and keep people in residential care and pay for the things that have, you know, that there was no choice about. What do we do in these really difficult situations? And so what we did internally is we did everything we could to avoid having to touch flexibility. We looked at our own departmental budget, which is only 3% of the $2.4 billion. It's very, very small. We've paused recruitment. We've looked at our own budget. We did a line-by-line review of all our contracts. We've done everything we can to avoid this, and
okay,
this is the situation.
Some more questions coming in. The Ministry of Disabled People, I'm informed, pays host agencies $980 a year per client for managing their account and a one-off $550 setup fee. That is millions of dollars spent on fees. Why? No other government support is administered this way. Why do you need the intermediary and pay millions for it?
So the host agencies provide support and people accessing their budgets, help provide some navigation, budget management, reporting, monitoring, etc. Now, these are the things, Catherine, that in a transformed system, you know, we have to look at how disabled people are supported with flexible funding. And I think the really important point that I want to make today is that this is a pause. We're now laser focused on working with our community to get the settings around that flexible part of the budget right.
Okay, here's another point not to be missed. This emailer says the funding in part exists as carer support. That means support for the carer. It is a hard grind as a mum of four special needs children, and me accessing, quote, support and, quote, respite enables me to be in the best position to help my kids. So I hear you talking about the essentials being equipment like wheelchairs, but the essentials are also, surely, keeping the carers able to care.
Absolutely. The carers can still access respite. What we're saying is that we've put a pause on paying for some of the activities that carers do. So, Catherine, I really want to emphasise that this is a really challenging set of circumstances. We are dealing with a system.
Are you telling me or are you telling your minister, Paula? You know? Because you just told me 3,000 more people each and every year.
That's right.
Sorry, I'm not angry at you. Forgive me. 3,000 people more each and every year require the support. We know what the costs of providing any kind of cost or service or facility are. They're up 30-40% in many instances prior to COVID. And yet the budget funding has not adjusted to this. And, you know, speaking of equipment, can you clarify for us, people who are worried that noise-cancelling headphones, that iPads for people who need them, who have sensitivity issues, who are on the spectrum, the minister said this morning that will still be available. Will it be?
So,
was she wrong to say that?
What I need to go back and listen to the transcript.
She said that people should be able to get that equipment.
And my understanding of what she was talking about is as we get the settings right.
Well, that's not what was implied.
So, okay, no, thank you for clarifying that. Look, I think what I want to say here too is when you start creating lists around people can have this but not that, but this but not that, this is where it gets really challenging, because what we actually want is for people to have the flexibility to spend the money that they want, and so in the way that they want, sorry, and doing that within settings which, you know, have been really, you know, changed significantly in the COVID era, and the budget and the settings have not changed to respond to that. So, you know, cost pressures from year to year have been met, but we're in a situation now where costs have been increasing, the number of people coming into the system is increasing, and the pressure on this budget is significant.
How would you describe the adequacy of the budget relative to the need? Enabling good lives is a beautiful term, but right now we're talking about enabling adequate ones, frankly. How would you describe the adequacy of the budget to the need?
So one of the things that's happened with this spend is the disability support system has become a default budget for where people ought to be able to access supports through other agencies. And so that's becoming a bit clearer to us now that Whaikaha has been established and we're much closer to the detail of this budget. And so actually what we want to do is make sure that disabled people can access the supports from agencies that they need, because that's not the sort of spend that has been taken into account in setting the budget for disability supports that we provide. So that's another issue that has impacted this budget. So, you know, I think we have been really clear in saying that this budget is under really significant pressure, and one of the significant pressure areas has been through the use of flexible funding. And we know that that works for people, and that's why that pressure has been on the budget. But it's incumbent on us now to work with the community to get the settings right and provide options to ministers for what those settings look like.
How can people contribute? 10,200, I think it was, responded within 24 hours to this news. How can those people have a say?
So we'll be coming out on the pause information. And I just want to emphasise again for people, Catherine, because it's really important for people to know this is a pause. We'll be coming out with information to really clarify the rules around travel and carer support, because I do think some of that has not been communicated and understood well. So we're providing some clarification around that. Then we'll be working, and you know, it's very, very hard obviously to consult with thousands of people, but we'll be working through different representative groups and setting up a process now to bring people in and work with them on what proposals for ministers could look like.
Thanks very much. That is Paula Tesorero speaking earlier there also to Prudence Walker, or who was the Disability Rights Commissioner.